Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our guest is Rick Solis. Rick wears lots of hats. He's an investor of real estate, the appraiser for all of our hard money loans, and occasionally we get him to come in and do a small training for appraising in our boot camps. Rick, welcome.
Thank you.
Appraising, how'd you get into it?
I started appraising because, two things. My mom was a processor when I was a teenager and a loan processor, and she kind of introduced me to it a little bit. But then I also was always interested in investing, so I started buying houses, and I was overpaying for them. So I started thinking, I better start learning how to figure out what these things are worth. So that's how I got into appraising. I got into appraising to become a better investor.
The appraisal world at that point, it didn't need a license, I wouldn't think.
Back when I started, you needed a clipboard and a tape measure, and you were an appraiser.
Okay. I'm just curious, do you think things have improved since they've had the education?
No. No, actually, it was the quality of appraisals were a lot better back then.
Without the education of trying to go through the state requirements?
Yeah, I think once the licensing got in, once they started the licensing implemented in the 1990s, pretty much anyone could pile in the door and be an appraiser. But when I started in the 80s, I mean, you had to get approved with each bank to be on their approved list to be an appraiser. Mm-hmm. And the guidelines were really stringent. I mean, you had to submit 6 work samples. A review appraiser would go through all those work samples. You had to have a bunch of references. They would double check all those. And the first slightest misstep and you were thrown off that bank's list. And it was more difficult back then. And once the licensing started coming into play, then they started easing up on all those restrictions, the quality of appraisals just declined substantially.
So when did you buy your first house? How old were you?
I closed escrow, and I never forget this because I was really pushing to get that closed before I turned 20, and it actually closed 1 week after my 20th birthday in March of 1988.
Holy mackerel.
So I was 20 years old in 1 week.
Now, was that in your family's background to own real estate, or you just decided you were going to go that route?
I had an uncle that did that, so I saw him doing that, but I got hooked into those late-night infomercials. So my first house was thanks to Dave Delgado, and the ones I bought after that were all thanks to Robert Allen.
Okay.
And those guys, and that was part of my problem, because those guys just talked about acquiring properties, doing anything you could to acquire it. They never talked about buying stuff below market. So that's why I had to start learning to be an appraiser, because I was getting great terms on this stuff, but the nothing down deals, you know, when you get something for nothing down, you usually overpay, and
yeah,
that's what I was doing.
Okay. We're going to talk about the investment side, yeah, in the next segment. So let me go back to the appraisal world for just a sec, because you've done appraising for what we would consider A paper loans, and now you're doing predominantly the appraisals for us as a hard money lender. How different is it appraising for a hard money lender versus an A paper?
Well, hard money lenders, the reason I really like doing your work, and it's just really, I mean, it's every appraiser's dream, is because you guys actually want to know what the property's worth. And you actually want to know everything that's wrong with it. And that is the complete opposite of what an A-paper appraisal, you know, is. The investor on the A-paper appraisal wants that, but everybody else in the transaction does not want that. The realtors don't want that. The sellers don't want that. The buyers don't want that. I mean, so if there's like a small termite issue, they don't want that anywhere on the appraisal. If you mention anything that is in fair condition on the property, they don't want that anywhere. I mean, these are all deal killers, which should be fixed or repaired, but you just can't disclose that anywhere on appraisal. Used to be we couldn't even check the box. It's a declining for market values. If you put that on the appraisal, it was the kiss of death for the whole transaction. So A-paper stuff, you really got to walk a fine line between killing their deal and, you know, doing the appraisal correctly versus hard money loan. I mean, the investor on the hard money loan really wants to know exactly what they're getting.
Now, the investor usually is a private person with money, but you could also have, I would think, a hard money lender that had a different intent than the Norris Group. I mean, you know us. We don't call you up and say, can you work on this number or can you reach this number? And I think that's kind of part of what's the problem with the appraisal industry is you feel a lot of pressure to come in at something. But you could have hard money lenders have the same thing. In other words, if it doesn't appraise at this, we probably don't have a deal.
I have had that. In fact, I've invested in some of those loans from those hard money lenders before and figured that out after the fact that I made a huge mistake. And I've also had those hard money lenders call me to do appraisals for them, and it is. I mean, they still put the same pressure on you as a realtor would, or a commissioned loan officer. And I've never gotten that pressure from Craig. I mean, he does not want any kind of funny business on any of those appraisals.
No, no.
He would rather pass on the deal if there's any kind of question than to take it.
Probably, I think, May of last year, there was an introduction of some new rules, HVCC.
Yeah.
What's been the effect on the appraisal industry for that new rule?
Well, now with that new rule, there's a third party in between the person that orders the appraisal, which used to be the loan officer or the lender, and the appraiser. And the third party is an appraisal management company. And the appraisal management company usually takes a percentage of the appraisal fee, and it's typically about 40%. So if the appraiser used to get $400 for an appraisal, now they get $240, and that's about the going rate with an appraisal management company. You get $240, and so a lot of the appraisers I know, like all the veteran ones, the ones that have been at it for 10, 15, 20 years, they've all left.
I mean, left the business?
Left the business entirely. I mean, they're doing something else for a living.
Well, I guess if you can't, if you got a 40% reduction of your earnings, the only way to make it up would be to do three at the same time frame it would have taken you to do two before.
I know. Well, I do know some few appraisers that do the appraisal management company stuff. And one guy, what he does is he only takes the stuff very, very close by, and he will also he'll look at the property, he'll pull up the comps and look at the what type of deal it is before he accepts it. And if there's anything that looks like it's going to be a problem, they'll have to explain it or provide additional comparables. He just passes on the deal. A few other people I know that are doing them, they just make it up in volume. I mean, so instead of working 80 or 40 hours a week, now they just work 80 hours a week to make the same income. But I would imagine there's a large percentage of appraisers that instead of spending maybe 8 hours on the appraisal, you know, they're getting paid, 60%. So maybe they're spending 5 hours doing it and just getting it done a lot faster.
I think generally people look at the appraisal process as very easy. They push a button and Zillow pops out and they go, what's the big deal?
Yeah, they do.
That's sort of dumbed down what the appraiser world is viewed at, but that is really a very inaccurate picture of how hard it is to come up with an accurate appraisal.
To come up with an accurate appraisal is difficult, but also to come up with an appraisal that meets all the guidelines from the lender, the investor that the lender's selling the loan to, and then the lender will also have, three or four different investors. Well, they used to have quite a few. Now it's probably just Fannie Mae, but that investor will, each one will have different guidelines, so they'll have their loan set up to adhere to the guidelines from several different sources. So to get all that done is a challenge.
If someone's selling a property to an FHA buyer, which is quite often the inventory that our guys deal with, what are some of the things that FHA really cares about as far as the end product?
Well, they've loosened up their requirements in the late 90s, early 2000s. FHA really clamped down on their property conditions. They used to have a four-page a legal-sized two-page checklist of all kinds of stuff you had to check for, and if any of those things were not up to their requirements, then they had to be repaired. I mean, there was a lot of conditions, too. If the crawl space underneath the house didn't have 18 inches of clearance, they had to...
I remember that.
it was just tons of stuff. Well, they've eased up and eliminated most of that, but they do have some items that they haven't let go of, and I don't think they will. And the one thing that they really don't like is chipping paint. So if there's any chipping paint anywhere on a house built before 1978, that needs to be taken care of. They don't like water heaters that aren't strapped and don't have temperature pressure release valves with overflow pipes. They don't like leaky roofs. But there are some things on the addendum that they do take. Like they will take old carpet or dirty carpet, as long as it's not a health hazard. There's quite a few things that they eased up on.
How do they feel about illegal conversions?
Well, that I get that quite a bit. And I've checked with HUD quite a few times, and actually the Office of Real Estate Appraisers, and they will accept non-permitted garage conversions or non-permitted additions as long as they're built in a workmanlike manner and there's no health or safety hazard. So if the appraiser takes photos of it, includes that, and makes a statement that there's no health or safety hazards, HUD and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac will accept that. However, many banks won't accept that. Many lenders won't accept that. Many underwriters won't accept that. And it just, you know, it's kind of hit and miss. But technically, if it's not a health hazard, they should accept it. And in fact, when I talked with the Office of Real Estate Appraisers, they said if it's a non-permitted addition, but it adds value to the property, so you can find comparable sales with similar non-permitted additions, if you can support that non-permitted addition actually adds value, you're supposed to give it value. And sometimes I've done that in the past, but you know the underwriters just don't like to see that. So it's a challenge, but they are supposed to accept it.
That's a lot of work to try and find a kind of a model match comp for an illegal addition.
It is a lot of work. You have to sift through, you know, 30 or 40 MLS listings and read them all to find that.
Do you have to physically? I mean, you don't physically go into comps, right?
No, but I can. I drive by them and I pull up the full MLS printouts for, you know, I usually look at, I probably start with 60 or 70 comparables, and I start like narrowing that down until I get to the 12 to 15 that look the most similar, and I'll drive by maybe 9 to 12 of those. And a lot of times you can spot that non-permitted addition from the front. I mean, you can see something in the backyard.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, you read through the listings to try to find that.
What type of improvements add more value than they cost in this market? Are there any?
Well, it seems like most of the stuff that you do, if your house is in average condition to start with, there's not too much that you can do that will necessarily that you'll get the money back from, like a pool or a spa or a new kitchen. It's when the houses are in bad condition and you start doing stuff that you really get a return on your money.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Okay.
Because let's say Moreno Valley, we've done our share of exactly that, where we've had a house that was without a kitchen and bathrooms were wrecked. And so, okay, we spend $30,000, but the house is only worth $150,000 maybe. So now I've got 20% of the value of the property in a rehab. Is that an issue for an appraiser?
Yeah, they won't give you, so you spent $30,000 rehabbing. No, they won't. The maximum they're allowed to adjust for any one-line item should be 10%. So if they adjust more than $15,000 for that condition, that will be a problem unless they find similar comparable sales that were renovated like yours that support that adjustment. So if you sold yours for $150,000 and everything else is selling for $120,000, and I'm saying I'm adjusting those comparables $30,000 to reflect the condition.
Mm-hmm.
I have a problem unless I can find at least one sale that doesn't require that adjustment. So at least one sale that sold at $150,000, preferably two or three. Well, preferably all my comps will be like that and won't require that adjustment. But if I don't have any comparables that don't require that adjustment, then I'm in trouble. It's going to be a huge problem.
One of the methodologies of appraising a property for residential is a cost basis. And I've always found that interesting. What does a cost basis have to do with today's value?
Nothing.
Okay.
Nothing.
Just checking.
And there was grumblings, you know, about 5 to 10 years ago that they were just going to delete that, the cost approach from the residential appraisals altogether, because it's really not relevant at all. In fact, most appraisers just kind of fudge those numbers. If you go into most appraisal offices, they don't have the recent copy of Marshall and Swift to do those accurate cost approaches. And no appraiser is spending, you know, half the day driving around or trying to find land sales to come up with a accurate land value. I mean, it's just the cost approach is kind of a joke.
Okay. Now, here I'm going to bring up an example where actually it might be useful. Let's say you were going to make an offer on a custom home lot, and you wanted to have the lot value be kind of emerge from what a custom home would be worth after it's done.
Okay.
So that would be like a residual value. So you're trying to prove to an owner of a lot, yeah, it used to be worth this, but here's the costs, and here's what's left after the appraisal. Would that be a useful tool?
Possibly. So you're saying you want a let's say you're going to build an $800,000 house, and the guy in the house, you're buying it a lot next door to one that's exactly like what you're going to build, and that house sold for $1 million next door. So you're saying that it's going to cost you $800,000 to build that same house. You're going to deduct that from the million and come up with $200,000, and that's what you're going to
in other words,
the lot's worth.
Yeah. So kind of reverse, kind of back to the value of the lot. And in this market, you'd probably have a pretty surprised owner looking at that his lot's probably not worth very much.
Yeah, I haven't done that for an appraisal before, and I haven't been requested that kind of assignment.
You're about to be, because I want you to do that for me, actually.
I don't know if I can pull that off.
Yeah,
I have to study that some more.
Well, I think what we'd have to do is figure out, construction cost, I think we have a pretty good idea of what that is by the
Absolutely.
People.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so then you just look at the comps and back out the cost and say, okay, that's the residual dirt value. And we're going to try it because I'm going to make an offer on a custom home lot late next week.
Yeah, I wouldn't even think you would need an appraisal for that. I mean, that seems pretty cut and dry. Here's what this sold for, a block away, and it costs this much to build that, and here's what's left over, and that's what I'll pay for your lot.
Yeah, there's something about it being in black and white that's good. They get to hold that for a while. Anyway, different subject. But when people have a home, they buy sometimes, and they really are still thinking like 05, 06, 07, where a flaw in a property or that might have a location problem or just a kind of a flow problem where you go in the house and it's awkward. Are investors really paying a price for that awkward inventory in 2010?
It seems like lately, in the last 6 months, investors are piling in and buying. That seems to be most of the stuff they're buying now, or location problems, floor plan problems, or, you know.
It's because that's all that's being offered to them?
That's all that's available. Otherwise, I mean, or just stuff that's fire damage or weird stuff next to a train track. They seem to be getting that stuff and selling it and not having as many problems as they would have, say, 2 years ago. 2 years ago, they couldn't have resold it at all. Now they're getting it sold. They are still taking a hit, but they're getting it, you know, below market. It all seems like it's washing out.
Okay. You probably get asked about what's an amenity worth. So how much does having a pool add to the value? How do you answer a question like that?
The way we're supposed to figure out what a pool is worth, say you have a house in Riverside that sold for $200,000 and you have one around the corner that's very similar that sold for $210,000, and the only difference being the house that sold for $210,000 is got the pool. So the difference being the $10,000 is what we assign to that pool, and that's what we would adjust everything else for having that pool. Every market's different. In some markets, like I had a house in Barstow that had a pool, and the pool was worth nothing. Versus, I've done appraisals in, I think, San Marino, in an area where the lots are, you know, a lot of the lots are in hillside areas, and a lot of the houses couldn't have pools, but the few that did have a flat lot, they were getting a huge premium. It might cost them $50,000 to build the pool, but they were getting $100,000 extra for the house just because they had the pool and they had the ability to have a pool. So every area is different. Most times I've seen that the value of a pool is about a percentage of what the house is worth, so anywhere from like 1 to 5%. So if the house sold for $100,000, I mean, the pool might be—I should say—it's more like between 0 and 5%. So $100,000 house, the pool might add $0 to $5,000. Up to about half the cost of the pool. So if you get to $1 million house, I mean, the pool's not going to add 50 grand more than likely. I mean, it just depends on the market, though.
Yeah, and that's what, kind of what I was leading to, is that that answer would be very different if you were in an 06 market compared to a 2010 market.
Not only that, it a lot of times it depends on the time of the market you're selling. I've sold houses with pools in October and November that didn't help me at all, versus selling a house with a pool in May. Like, I've got one in Beaumont coming up that's got a pool that we're putting on the market in a couple weeks, and I think that's just going to be golden.
Yeah, because somebody's going to be hot.
Yeah, and they're going to look at that pool, and nice and clean blue pool, and that's going to be a huge selling feature.
That's funny. I hadn't really thought of that one. What about you're appraising a house and it's got similar square footage, but one has a four-bedroom and the other's a three-bedroom?
If the area, and it depends on the area, but if what your house has is typical for the area, so most of the homes are three-bedrooms and you have a four-bedroom, a 1,200-square-foot four-bedroom house with four small bedrooms versus a 1,200-square-foot three-bedroom house with three bigger bedrooms, a lot of times I've noticed that the fourth bedroom doesn't really impact the value much, unless it's not typical for the area. So if everything in that neighborhood is a four-bedroom and you've got a two-bedroom but they're the exact same square footage, then the impact of not having those extra two bedrooms could be pretty big.
That makes sense. One's going to have a family and one's not capable of having it. So a different utility for sure.
Absolutely. Well, and it depends on the people, because I know my mom, dad, they don't have any kids that live at home anymore. So they would much rather have three bigger bedrooms than four, you know, 10 by 10 bedrooms.
If you had to choose the top three things to look out for if you're appraising a property as an investor, what would they be?
For me personally, I mean, I've been at it now for 20 years, so I don't want anything with a location problem at all. I will avoid that. I don't want anything that is not typical for the area and I can't fix. And I don't want any weird stuff. So I don't want the modular or the manufactured home surrounded by nothing but, you know, track built stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want the 1950s built house surrounded by all brand new construction. I don't want the dome home. I don't want I don't want anything weird unless it's typical for the area.
Okay. Do you find that investors sometimes are looking at houses that are much newer and they're buying something older and they somehow think that's because it's the same size that that's a comp?
Yeah, I've seen that happen quite a bit, and I understand how they can make that mistake, and it doesn't seem logical. Like, why wouldn't a remodeled 1970 built house, you know, that you just spent 50 grand remodeling, why won't that sell for the same as like a 2005 built house that's in similar condition? But I've just seen it happen time and time and time again over, you know, 22 years or however long I've been doing this, that the newer built house will always command the premium versus the older house. And so that is something that I see people make a mistake a lot. I mean, they look at their house built in the 50s and they're comparing it to stuff built in the 80s, and it just doesn't work out for them. I mean, especially if you're in like Moreno Valley or Paris or Rialto, and that's where it seems to happen the most. They're getting the house built in 1955 in Rialto and they're comparing it to the stuff built in like 1988 in Rialto, and it's just not the same.
We're down to our last minute. How about a Mello Roos house where you have a tax bill that's, let's say, maybe 2.5 times another tract in the area? Do you consider that as a very big detriment to value?
Absolutely. If I see that type of thing, I try to get comparables that all have similar tax bases. However, I think a lot of the first-time buyers don't catch on to that. I think the move-up buyers are the ones that know that, figure that out, and they don't want to deal with that. The first-time buyers, they don't always catch on to that and notice the difference.
Well, we're almost out of time. Rick, when you buy one of those homes at a much lower price than was originally sold for, is only part of the tax bill lowered?
I don't know.
I think that's probably true. I'm sure the Mello Roos part of it's still there. Anyway, Rick, thanks for joining us. Rick Solis, and he'll be appraising your house if you get a loan from us. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.